Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm taking another look at Deflate's channel. This video, he's trying to demonstrate that the Gospels are reliable, or at least to counter a couple of the objections against their reliability. So, let's find out why we should trust the Gospels!
The Gospels are full of contradictions, and we don't even know who wrote them in the first place, so clearly they cannot be trusted.
Well, neither of those things is a slam dunk case against trusting them. Often, contradictions in historical documents are how we work out what really happened, because we can use them to parse out the various biases of the authors, and so can piece together which parts of the different accounts are less likely to be affected by these biases. And being anonymously written is not in and of itself a massive problem, but it is easier to trust a document to be accurate when it comes from an author who we know of from their other works to be generally trustworthy. And if we can't figure out who the author is to begin with, that makes this task nearly impossible. There's also the question of what parts of the document do we consider trustworthy. It's not an all-or-nothing deal where we decide that a document is reliable so everything in it must be true, or it's unreliable so everything in it must be false. It's usually going to be a mix.
Chances are you've heard these two arguments, or even made them yourself, which is why we're about to debunk them in this video.
Yeah, I have made both of those arguments in the past. Which is why I already, before even getting into the video, know that there's more to them than you're presenting here.
First, yes, the Gospels were written anonymously. Nowhere does Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John say that they actually wrote the Gospels which have come to bear their name.
Okay then, case closed. They are anonymously authored documents. Next point.
Some skeptics chomp on that and claim that anyone really could have written the Gospels, possibly even people who lived long after them.
It's not so much that just anybody could have written the Gospels. Rather, it's that what we can learn of the authors from examining their writing is incompatible with who the authors are supposed to be. They are all highly educated in Greek literary style, which doesn't exactly line up with the education level of your average Galilean fisherman in first century Judea. There's also the fact that even if we go with the church tradition idea of who wrote the Gospels, we're then left with the curious situation where two people who were supposed to be eyewitnesses to the events that they describe, Matthew and Luke, also copied directly, word for word, from an account that is universally agreed by church tradition and biblical scholars alike to have not been written by an eyewitness. That would be like if I decided to write the story of the life of my children, but instead of writing it all myself, I copy large chunks from other people who are retelling stories that they heard about my children, which I would have been present for. Like, there's nothing in the laws of physics that says it's impossible, but that would be really, really weird.
However, it's important to know that the Gospels are certainly not the only ancient documents whose authors didn't identify themselves.
No, but a key difference here is that ancient works that are not in the Bible are not generally considered to be the perfect word of an all-knowing, all-powerful God. So you would expect that such a work of writing would be able to stand up to higher levels of scrutiny than other works from that time period, just based on the entity that is supposed to be its ultimate source. Unfortunately, you instead need to lower the bar in order to make them look reliable.
Far from raising the bar or the epistemic standard that Christianity must meet to be believed, I lower it.
Just as an example, consider a work called the Annals, by far the most important source from which contemporary historians get their information about the Roman Empire during the first century. This key text is attributed to Tacitus, a Roman senator and historian who lived at the time, and yet nowhere in the Annals did Tacitus identify himself as the author.
No, he didn't. At least not in any of the parts that we have access to. Many of the books that were contained in the Annals have been lost to history, so it is possible that he identified himself in those, but it's also irrelevant. There are actually several ways that we know Tacitus was the author. For instance, we have many of his other works and can compare his style. His style was actually quite unique and would be very difficult for an impersonator to imitate, especially in as large and as heavily a detailed work as the Annals, not to mention the fact that both the Annals and histories, together comprising 30 books use sources that Tacitus had access to because of his position in the Roman Senate. We also have correspondence between Tacitus and other prominent figures from the time, such as Pliny the Younger, where they discuss his progress on writing both the histories and the annals, which would be a really weird thing for them to talk about if it wasn't Tacitus doing the actual writing. Is there anything equivalent to that for the Gospels?
Even so, no one questions Tacitus' authorship as it's clearly supported by external evidence.
On the contrary, the way we established Tacitus' authorship was by questioning it.
Such as other texts from the same period which make reference to the annals and consistently mention Tacitus as its author.
Yes, exactly. There are other documents that we have that are contemporary to Tacitus which confirm the authorship. People that not only knew that Tacitus was the author, but who actually knew Tacitus personally, were referring to these works as having been written by Tacitus.
The very same thing applies in the case of the Gospels.
Really? People who were friends of the authors identify them as the authors during the time when they were still either being written or were just recently written? I find that incredibly doubtful. Such amazing evidence for authorship would not be ignored, and the consensus among biblical scholars is that the Gospels were not written by the people whose names are attached to them. And a lot of these biblical scholars, who also happen to be Christians, would undoubtedly jump on any evidence that suggested otherwise.
The Church Fathers referenced them copiously and consistently attributed them to the four traditionally accepted authors.
Okay, but that is a long way off from having friends of the authors writing about their work in progress while it's being written. The Church Fathers are all from the second half of the second century, some 50 to 100 years after the Gospels were written, depending on the Gospel and the Church Father we're talking about. In a lot of cases, we don't actually have the writings of the Church Fathers themselves, we have later authors attributing statements to them. So, for example, the tradition of Mark being written by a guy named John Mark, who was writing down the teachings of Peter in Rome, comes to us through a big long telephone game. Eusebius tells us that Papias said that John the Elder told him that John Mark wrote Mark based on what Peter told him. That's not exactly great attestation, especially since we're not even sure who John the Elder is. It's thought by some that John the Elder is the same John who is mentioned as a disciple of Jesus, and who allegedly wrote the Gospel of John, but that is uncertain to say the least. And this is actually one of the better attestations attempting to tie a Gospel author with a particular person. When it comes to Matthew, we get arguments along the lines of, Matthew the tax collector is thought to have written the book of Matthew, and that would explain the fact that Matthew mentions money a lot. Okay, that's not quite it for Matthew, that's some of the textual evidence that's used to support the idea. The earliest reference we have to the book of Matthew having been written by the disciple Matthew is Eusebius in the 4th century, again quoting Papias from the 2nd century, saying that Matthew compiled some sayings of Jesus in Hebrew, which everybody then interpreted as best they could. Which isn't great, considering the fact that the textual analysis of Matthew shows that it was not a translated work, but was originally written in Greek. At best, this could mean that Matthew the disciple wrote some things down that may or may not have been included in the later book of Matthew. But also, with the phrasing that's attributed to Papias, it still leaves us wondering, did Matthew write a story of his own, or was he just collecting things that other people wrote? And did this alleged work actually get included in the book of Matthew? It's unclear at best, and at worst it's doubtful that such a work even existed in the first place. As to Luke, the author basically states flat out in the opening that he was not an eyewitness to the events, but is compiling his story based on other sources. Tradition holds that the author of Luke and Acts was Luke the physician who traveled with Paul, but such a view is no longer the consensus, though it is generally thought that the author of Luke was indeed a student of Paul, at least for part of Paul's career, but we really have no way of knowing which student or companion of Paul's it was, and there is no indication that it is Luke the physician. Now, because we do have a second work by this author, this is probably the gospel author that we know the most about, and we still can't figure out who it was. As to John, there's a lot that can be said about why we know it wasn't written by the John that's mentioned as the disciple of Jesus, but for now I'll just leave it at the point where John mistakenly mentions several times that Jesus and his followers were put out of the synagogues, when in reality Christians were considered another sect of Judaism until sometime between 70 and 90 CE. They did their worshipping in the synagogues right up until they weren't allowed to anymore, which happened closer to 90. This is actually one of the methods that we use to date the Book of John. If he were writing before 90, he would have been aware that Christians worshipped in the synagogues as Jews, and so would not have included the stories about Jesus and his followers being kicked out. Like, if he were with Jesus during his ministry and was a witness to the events, he would have been aware that Christians were allowed in the synagogues. The mention of John having been written by the disciple John comes mainly from Irenaeus, but again we run into the problem of figuring out who John the Elder is, as there are two potential Johns that Irenaeus could be referring to, and the evidence points more toward the author of the Gospel not being the guy from the story of Jesus.
In fact, there is not a single instance known to us when a canonical gospel is attributed to anyone other than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
I fail to see the relevance. That is entirely an argument from silence. You don't need someone to claim that, for instance, Bartholomew wrote the Gospel of John in order to show that it was unlikely to have been written by the John that's in the story. The fact of the matter is that the actual evidence points directly away from the traditionally attributed authors being the actual authors, and this isn't evidence compiled by skeptics making a case against the Gospels. It's compiled by New Testament scholars, most of whom are Christians themselves. And I have barely even scratched the surface on this evidence.
Thus, we have every reason to ascribe the Gospels to these four, so the burden of proof is on the skeptics to offer us a more plausible option.
Well, we don't need to provide a more plausible option in the sense that we need to figure out the actual name of someone who better fits the bill for authorship, but like I said, the evidence does point away from those attributions being accurate. So until we find some better evidence, right now the scholarly consensus is that we do not know who wrote the Gospels. You need more than attestation of authorship from a century after the fact in order to support your position, especially given that such attestation runs counter to the facts that we have about the Gospels and the people who are alleged to have written them.
The second problem that's often brought up is the fact that there are differences in the Gospel accounts.
It's a lot more in-depth than that. It's not just that there are differences, it's the nature of these differences, and also the fact that there are similarities that are more than just casually similar. They are word-for-word copies of each other at times. So, for differences, we have issues with certain details. For example, the crucifixion narrative in the Synoptic Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, cannot take place in the same year as the version found in John. All four Gospels agree that Jesus was crucified on a Friday, but the Synoptics have this Friday being the day after Passover, while John has it being the day before the Passover. If they agree on the day of the week that Jesus was crucified on, but disagree on the day of the week that Passover was on, then that means that they are not taking place in the same year. But for similarities, we are once again left with the idea that Matthew and Luke, supposedly eyewitnesses despite Luke stating flat out that he is not, were copying their books word for word from the book written by the one gospel author that church tradition says was definitely not an eyewitness. So it's a combination of the fact that there are several irreconcilable contradictions combined with just outright plagiarism on the part of the Synoptics, which then leads us to the conclusion that they were not eyewitness accounts.
For example, Matthew tells us that Jesus healed two blind men as he was leaving Jericho, whereas Luke wrote that Jesus healed one blind man as he was entering Jericho. Mark agrees with Matthew about the fact that Jesus was leaving Jericho, but like Luke, he features only one blind man.
I'm gonna go out on a limb here and guess that you're going to apply the same reasoning here as is done with the women at the tomb. Just because two of the accounts said he healed a blind man doesn't mean that he healed just the one. Despite that being a really weird way to refer to the event if he did indeed heal more than one.
How can that be? In other instances, the Gospels seem to differ about the chronological order of things, or one Gospel may mention stuff which others don't.
Yeah, there are definitely a bunch of minor discrepancies scattered throughout. They're not a huge deal, but they definitely don't help build the case that these books are ultimately the work of an all-knowing God, even if indirectly.
On the surface, this seems like a real problem, but as we're about to see, these differences actually support rather than undermine the reliability of the Gospels.
So, you're gonna go the J. Warner Wallace route and claim that the differences are no more than the differences in perspective between witnesses, all while ignoring the blatant plagiarism that completely defeats this point? Okay, have fun with that, I guess.
Imagine an architect, a sound engineer, a carpenter, and a violinist attending a concert together. Imagine that you interviewed them one by one about their experience. Clearly, their reports would differ, and some of the differences might actually be rather significant.
Yeah, and sometimes when the witnesses are mere mortals without a direct connection to an all-knowing God, some of them will be mistaken. One of them might say they really enjoyed that rendition of In the Hall of the Mountain King, while another insists that they never played that, they played Night on Bald Mountain instead. This may or may not be based on a real conversation I had with my dad once. I won't say any more about it except to point out that those are two very different compositions that are very easy to tell apart. But you'd expect such disagreements to not be possible in the perfect Word of God. And yeah, I'm sure you can come up with a post hoc explanation that would make both of us correct. Maybe one of us went to the washroom during Night on Bald Mountain, and the other went during In the Hall of the Mountain King. That would certainly account for this discrepancy, sure, but a simpler and much more likely solution is just that one of us was mistaken. Now, with the Gospels, take this problem and amplify it by a couple orders of magnitude, and that's the scale we're talking about here. Now we can all predict where this concert analogy is going, and yeah, it does go exactly where you think it does, so I'm just gonna skip the rest of it.
Now, in contrast to all that, imagine instead that all of their reports agreed word for word. Wouldn't that be fishy?
Why, yes, that would be fishy. But in this case, we don't just have accounts that agree word for word, we have accounts that agree word for word in Greek about statements that would have originally been made in Aramaic. So let's say these concertgoers all speak English, and all the evidence suggests that none of them would have ever learned a second language, but somehow their accounts all agree with each other word for word, but in perfectly fluent French. That's the scenario for the Synoptic Gospels, but don't take my word for it. Here's New Testament scholar Dr. Mike Lycona's version of essentially the same analogy.
When I did my 8-year focus study on gospel differences, at the end, what really impresses you are not the differences, but the similarities
right.
with the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Because the way I'd explain it is this. If, let's say, the five of us are at a restaurant and we're having dinner, and we notice a couple at the table next to us and they're having an argument, and we're watching that argument intensify over the course of 10 minutes. And finally the couple stand up and they're yelling at each other, and the woman takes a wine bottle and breaks it across the guy's cheek. And just then the paramedics, the police come, they arrest the woman, take her off in cuffs, the paramedics work on the guy's face. Police officer comes over and asks the five of us at that moment to report, write down independently what we saw
yeah.
and what we heard. Like you say, there's gonna be variation in eyewitness testimony. There's gonna be a lot of similarities, there's gonna be a lot of differences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the police officer gets those back and he looks and sees there's virtually verbatim, word for word, in many of those instances, that police officer is gonna know, be suspicious that there was collusion involved, collaboration mm-hmm. involved, but there's more.
Mm-hmm.
That couple was arguing in Spanish. Now, fortunately, we're all fluent in Spanish,
mm-hmm.
but the police officer is not. So the police officer asks
right.
us to translate that into English.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anyone who's remotely familiar with another language knows that there's no one-on-one correspondence in translations. And even you'll translate something differently tomorrow than you translated today.
Sure.
But when they get it back and they see that there's still a one-to-one correspondence in many cases, word for word, in our translation of what was said and done, the police officer all the more is going to be suspicious that we have colluded with one another. But there's still more. Because it's not just 20 minutes later that we're doing this,
mm-hmm.
it's 30, 40 or more years later that
right.
we're recalling those things, word for word translated. Now the police officer is rightly going to know that we worked with one another on this.
That clip was a bit on the long side, but that is the point that I'm making. The Synoptic Gospels are not independent eyewitness accounts. They are copies and compilations that built on previously existing material, and the main source for Matthew and Luke was the gospel that nobody, not even the early church fathers, thought was actually written by an eyewitness.
The thing is that eyewitness testimonies about one and the same event differ from one another, and that's just natural.
Yeah, But sometimes you can't reconcile those differences without first coming to realize that at least one of the witnesses was wrong about something. So for instance, to bring it back to the example I used before, was Passover before or after Jesus was crucified? It can't be both, and yet the Gospels disagree on that. So at least one of the Gospels has to be wrong.
In fact, detectives or judges who routinely deal with eyewitness accounts actually expect such differences. In contrast, if a detective or a judge listening to, let's say, four eyewitnesses gets to hear four exactly identical stories, they would immediately suspect collusion and thus question the authenticity of the accounts.
Okay, so there was collusion with the Gospels, so we should definitely question their authenticity. Gotcha. And I feel like I've made this clear, but just to be absolutely explicit about it, I can see the objections now about how I am both saying that the books are too similar and also too different. Well, remember at the beginning when I pointed out that this isn't an all-or-nothing endeavor? There are segments that are identical, word for word, in Greek, a language that would not have been spoken by Jesus' disciples. And not small segments either. About 94% of the book of Mark was copied word for word into the book of Matthew. About 79% of Mark was copied into Luke, word for word. All told, only about 3% of Mark is unique to Mark, having not been copied into either of the other synoptics. But when the stories diverge, man, do they ever diverge. And also related, but not really relevant, just something I find interesting, is that Mark made extensive use of literary devices, which Matthew had a tendency to break. For instance, when Jesus curses the fig tree, in Mark he goes for figs, sees no fruit on the tree because it's not the season for it, curses the tree, then goes to the temple, does the cleansing of the temple, and returns to the fig tree to find it withered and dead, and then uses that as a jumping off point for a sermon. That's a literary device, with the fig tree bracketing the cleansing of the temple as an allegory for the fact that the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. It's not the season for the fruit of the temple anymore, it's withered and destroyed. Matthew, though, as he tended to do in other places, completely missed the literary device, or at least didn't see the value in it, so instead of having two separate trips to the fig tree, he smushed it together into one single event, and thereby ruined the literary brackets that Mark had set up.
For the same reason, historians too expect eyewitness accounts from the past to differ from one another. Therefore, the fact that the Gospels don't agree on every single detail speaks for and not against them.
Not if they're supposed to be completely without contradiction. Even in this simple fig story, the fact that Matthew condensed it into one single trip to the fig tree is a contradiction with the idea that Jesus went to this tree twice. It's not a significant detail, I mean, unless we're concerned with keeping Mark's literary devices intact, but that's another matter. So it's not a significant detail, but in order to reconcile these two accounts, again, at least one of them has to be factually wrong.
Now let's get to the healing of the blind man in Jericho. It's important to know that in Jesus' time there were actually two Jerichos, the old town of Jericho, which is the one known from Old Testament times, as well as a new Jericho, which was built by Herod the Great around 1 mile south of the old one.
Well, when I look this up, the first page of Google results for multiple different search terms related to this was chock full of apologetics websites attempting to harmonize this exact story. That's a massive red flag. If you can't find archaeologists talking about there being two Jerichos, but the apologists are all over that shit, you should immediately begin to doubt the accuracy of the apologists. After doing a bit of digging past the websites from places like the esteemed bastion of scholarship that is Kyle Butt's Apologetics Press, I did find that there have been multiple historical sites that could be referred to as Jericho, but specific to the time of Jesus, there's really no evidence that there was a second Jericho that was inhabited and known as Jericho at the time. Basically, there was a mound that could have been the Jericho from the Old Testament, but was almost certainly not inhabited after the 6th century BCE, and Herod built a bunch of palaces around the time of Jesus in the Jericho Valley, but not at that mound that could have been Old Jericho. It's ultimately unlikely that anyone living in Jesus' time would have referred to these two different places as Jericho simultaneously, so this method of reconciling that contradiction is more than a bit of a stretch.
Thus, a plausible explanation is that the healing happened in between the two Jerichos.
A more plausible explanation, in my opinion, is that these are just two different instances of healing a blind person, one on the way in and two on the way out. Well, the numbers don't really match for that, but I'm sure you can fix that with the "they didn't say there was just one blind man" apologetic, so there you go.
as Jesus was leaving one of them, which is what Matthew and Mark say, while he was heading for the other one, as Luke recounts. And as far as the number of blind men is concerned, Mark and Luke don't say that there was one man only, which leaves the option of there being more than one.
Yeah, there it is. You'd think that God would be able to keep his numbers straight. Like, even if I agree that these are eyewitness accounts, there are so many apparent errors that God would have been able to avoid if he were actually planning out his perfect book. But he didn't, so that calls divine inspiration into question.
Also note that in Matthew, the men are not named, whereas Mark mentions Bartimaeus, one of the blind beggars, by name.
Yeah, do note that. Remember how I said Matthew liked to break Mark's literary devices? This is likely another instance of this happening. Bartimaeus is a really weird name. It's a mixture of Aramaic and Greek, and as Mark points out, it literally means son of Timaeus. Why is that important? Well, the Greek philosopher Plato happened to title one of his dialogues Timaeus, and one of the primary themes of that particular dialogue is about sight being the foundation of knowledge. That seems like quite the apropos reference in a story about Jesus bringing sight to a blind man. But Matthew, poor old Matthew, who actually was highly educated despite his tendency to miss these references, just didn't see the need to include the name, so he skipped it, and so broke another one of Mark's literary devices. I mean, Luke did too, but I'm picking on Matthew here, so that's who I'm focused on. Leave me alone.
Thus, it could be that Mark actually knew Bartimaeus personally, which is why he chose to focus the narration of the healing on him only, even though he was perfectly aware that the second person was present.
I really like how you're using a literary reference to Plato as evidence that the one guy who church tradition says was not a witness was actually an eyewitness. Find a better argument, dude. The church fathers who you claim lend credibility to the claim that the Gospels are eyewitness accounts wouldn't even agree with you here.
Bartimaeus could also have been the one of the two blind men who led the conversation with Jesus, which is why Mark and Luke honed in on him, without, however, explicitly denying that a second blind man got healed too.
Careful you don't pull a muscle with that reach.
So clearly, neither the differences between the Gospels nor their anonymity really pose a problem for their reliability.
It kinda does, though, especially given how much you had to bend the truth in order to get to the idea that the Gospels were written by the people whose names are on them.
Another issue skeptics often bring up is that neither Jesus nor the Apostle Paul ever taught that God is a Trinity, but that this idea is a later pagan invention.
I'd actually never heard that it was a later pagan invention, though that doesn't really surprise me, but there is no mention of the Trinity in the Bible, except for one spot where we know that it was actually a scribal insertion that was made centuries after the original text was written, and so isn't really in the Bible.
If you want to find out why this is wrong and why the New Testament clearly implies that God is triune, check out this video over here.
No, I won't be doing that because internal theological arguments are rather pointless for me. It'd be like watching people who think vampires are real having a serious argument about whether or not garlic actually repels them. Because I don't think they're real in the first place, it could not matter less which side wins. But I left that in because I do find it interesting that he had to say that the New Testament clearly implies a triune God. Well, if the Trinity were a real thing, and a thing that is as important to the theology of Christianity as Christians seem to think it is, you'd think that he could have done better than to just imply it in his holy book. Maybe give it an explicit mention or two. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Jimmy Ray, who says, "Eviolution doesn't work anymore. It fails in the lab with many scientists. Creation has much better answers for the origin of all things." A few things here. First, if it doesn't work anymore, then that implies that there was a time when it did work. What caused it to stop, in your mind? Second, how did it fail in the lab? In my Evidence for Evolution series, I actually have a whole video dedicated specifically to times that it has been observed in a lab, and I just picked the first three experiments that I could remember offhand when I made that video. There are a lot more of them. Last, creation does not have better answers. Creation has non-answers. Saying God did it doesn't actually help us understand anything about how it happened. It's equally as helpful as me saying the eternal Knuckle of E created everything. So, how did God do his creating? What about him saying, "Let there be light," caused photons to come into existence? What mechanism did he use when he was making photons? And did he really spend an entire day creating the Earth, but then sneezed out the entire rest of the universe in a single sentence? How did he create the rest of the universe? Did he make it out of pre-existing material, or did he make it out of nothing? If he made it out of nothing, what mechanism made the creation of stuff out of nothing possible? These are all questions that are brought up by the creation model, and none of them will ever be answered by creation. Functionally speaking, saying God did it is the same as saying it was magic. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, who are the plagiarism to the Gospels that are my channel. If you'd like to be ignored when future rhino apologists claim that I am inerrant, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicedrino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicedrino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!